Welcome to Understory, this 27th of February 2019. I'm Elizabeth Poe. Next week, on Tuesday, March the 5th, is a big day for Western Australia because an important case is being heard in the Supreme Court, and with that court case, some very important issues about the environment will be considered. It may surprise you to learn that when an environment matter goes to a higher court in Western Australia, it's not concerned with the details of that matter, not about whether Stygo fauna will be made extinct or not, not about whether coal is actually causing climate change. This can only happen in WA on the basis of a technicality, and it can only happen when the community raises enough money to support and pay for legal counsel to pursue a legal argument. There is a West Australian Environmental Defenders Office, which is a non-government organisation, but it lives off the smell of an oily rag, and successive governments have defunded or underfunded that NGO. Our governments have little interest in having their own decisions challenged by the people of WA. The legal case being heard in the Supreme Court of Western Australia next week is complicated and seems far removed from important issues of species survival, but until our state Labor government introduces an environment court, it's all we've got. So what are the issues? According to speakers at a forum at the University of Western Australia last week, there are at least three issues. Firstly, the limitations of the existing environmental protection laws. Secondly, the issues of extinction they raise. And thirdly, the role of the minister's personal discretion in the environmental law process. There are other issues around the legal processes of protection of species and their habitat. MC for the evening was Dave Sweeney.
My name is Dave Sweeney. I work and lead ACF, the Australian Conservation Foundation's Nuclear Free Work. I'm generally based at ACF's national office in Melbourne, and it's a real pleasure to be here. This is an issue far beyond WA Goldfields. It is an Australia-wide and beyond issue, because what we have here is a question of what values, what priorities, what legal protections, and what choices we make. An extractive industry with a poisonous product, or species and extinction. These are really profound questions and very important stuff.
Piers Verstegen is the Director of the Conservation Council of Western Australia.
The Environmental Protection Act, the act that is being challenged in the court or essentially reviewed by the court, that was the first attempt at serious environmental law here in Western Australia. And that act, that legislation, is only there because of the efforts of community and conservation groups as part of the Conservation Council. The EPA almost never says no to any kind of proposal. One of the key reasons why the EPA came to the view that this proposal was unacceptable was because of the outstanding work of Mia Pepper and other people who were engaged in that environmental impact assessment process. And that generally doesn't occur, sadly, in environmental impact assessment, that you have people of that kind of calibre, that level of dedication, that are engaging in that process and providing that input to the EPA. Now, we're talking about a mine here, which is actually a 9-kilometre-long open pit. And that's why you have that really significant impact on the Stygo fauna. Of course, it would use 8.7 million litres of water per day in an extremely arid environment. And, of course, it would also generate 36 million tonnes of radioactive waste, which would remain radioactive in the environment for tens of thousands of years. So it was a shunky decision made at 5 minutes to midnight while bulldozers were in the Beale wetlands without any ability to apply community scrutiny at the time that decision was made. I don't know any other legal jurisdiction that has a God clause in it that allows a minister, under the Biodiversity Protection Act, to allow extinction to occur, a specific clause in that legislation. And the Conservation Council and other groups continue to challenge that, not just in the courts through the Environmental Protection Act, but we continue to call for law reform to get proper protection for our wildlife and our habitat and get rid of that God clause out of our Wildlife Protection Act here in Western Australia. It's pretty difficult sometimes to engage the broader community in the need for environmental law reform because it tends to be a bit boring, but the EDO are doing a fantastic job, and through the Conservation Council and other groups, we have to do that. We have to challenge ourselves to actually get engaged in something which might sound a bit boring because it has profound consequences for our environment, for our species and our communities.
Dr. Hugh Finn is a lecturer at Curtin Law School, Curtin Uni, also acting convener of the EDO in WA. And Hugh's current research is focused on regulatory frameworks for human activities that harm wild animals.
So the Cameco's responses to the public submission to the Public Environmental Review for the uranium mine indicated that these submissions from the WA Museum included this, that the subterranean fauna of the Yeelirrie site is by far the most diverse local subterranean fauna in the world. Furthermore, many of the species are themselves endemic to the site. The development of a shallow and thus extensive open pit mine in the core of this distribution will disrupt this community and is likely to lead to species extinction. Now, why would a Minister for Environment decide that a uranium mine was acceptable in a landscape as special as that? And the basic message I'd like to convey tonight is that for nearly 200 years in which settler law has imposed itself on the state, the prevailing public philosophy has been that we ought to improve the land of the state and bring it out of a wasteful state and into productive use. The outcome of that vision, that ideology, is extinction, is the destruction of landscapes and the passage of species into extinction, and the acceptance of that outcome, that it is okay for some species to be extincted. What runs counter to that vision, to that ideology, is the notion that there is something extant in the land, the vegetation, the animals, the ancestors, the communities of being, the legacies, the continued ongoing creativities of all kinds of processes over all kinds of time. And that belonging is what we need if our children, the future generations of this state, are to share the land with all the species extant today. And if we have a look at the national threatened list, or these are the species that are listed as extinct, 4 frogs, 22 birds, 27 mammals, and one other animal, the Lake Petter earthworm. By way of context, that's about the 27 mammals, that's about 10% of the endemic terrestrial endemic mammal fauna, and that's been done over the last 200 years. These are the number of species on the EPBC list of threatened fauna in the critically endangered, and vulnerable categories. And if the declines of those species continue, that will be sufficient to ensure that Australia will also participate in the Earth's sixth mass extinction, an event that we can still prevent, but that we are very much on the cusp of. So some of you may have heard of the pipistrelle bat on Christmas Island, and that criterion of no reasonable doubt that the last member of the species has died is actually very applicable here. And I'll just... So it's not very often you actually get to, someone catches the actual moment of the last species of going into extinction. But of course, conservation biology will tell us that the species is doomed long before we get to the solitary individual remaining. So species consist of populations, and the pathway to extinction begins when populations of a species begin to disappear from landscapes, one local extinction after another, until finally the species has disappeared from all of the landscapes it once appeared in. And those of you who are familiar with the Carnaby's cockatoo in the wheat belt will know that pattern very well, how it's disappeared from much of the wheat belt. So I can't say whether the copepods and the other stygofauna at Yeelirrie would suffer if they were extincted. I don't know. A brief look at the literature suggests that crustacean welfare is actually an area of active scientific debate and legislative consideration. But I know that mammals, birds, and reptiles suffer, and that a long history of suffering underlies the progress of a species towards extinction. A recent report by the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, of global warming of 1.5 degrees Celsius, and by way of context, we're already at 1 degree Celsius of warming, stated that even achieving emissions reductions targets consistent with the ambitious goal of 1.5 degrees C of global warming under the Paris Agreement will result in the further loss of 70 to 90% of reef-building corals compared to today. Now, how many creatures is that? How many creatures will suffer and die and vanish from the earth as one coral reef after another bleaches, and then bleaches again, and then bleaches again, and then finally dies as the ocean temperatures rise and rise? Extreme heat events. And for example, the heat wave in Queensland last November killed more than 23,000 spectacled flying foxes, about a third of the total species population. So when you look and see the minister and the prime minister and they talk about climate change being nothing and having no effect, well, that's not true. But there is things that we can all do to help prevent extinction. We need to make West Australia a zero carbon state. We need to make climate change the central issue in the upcoming federal campaign. We need to tell the West Australian government you want a clean state and a zero carbon state, that you want zero net emissions in Western Australia, that you want to transform the state's economy into a zero carbon economy, that you want strong regulation of carbon pollution from gas exporters. Tell Chevron and other corporations that they must take responsibility for the harm their emissions cause. This is not the time to be timid in what we demand of our politicians or from the corporations that profit from the resources of this state. The other thing we can do is tell the EPA to consider the welfare of individual animals in their decision making. The EPA is, of course, mainly concerned about whether a proposal is likely, if implemented, to have a significant effect on the environment. However, the concept of significant effect on the environment under the Environmental Protection Act 1986 is broad enough to include the harm that land clearing and other processes will cause to individual animals. Notably, Section 3.1, lawyers always like subsections, of the Environmental Protection Act defines environment to mean living things, their physical, biological, and social surroundings, and interactions between all of these. The harming or killing of a living thing, therefore, falls within the concept of an effect on the environment. Lastly, I'm going to finish up tonight talking about, in this state, two systems of law, and I'll call them First Law and Settler Law. Now, settler law began as point of settlement about 200 years ago. And by settler law, I mean all of the common law, all of the statutory law that the British brought along with them and that we've made since then has as its guiding philosophy the belief that we ought to improve the land of the state and bring it into productive use. And that underlies things like the Planning and Development Act. It underlies the Environmental Protection Act. Unused land is wasteland. That view, expressed in the work of John Locke and others, was integral to the legal and political basis by which Australia was colonised and by which Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples were dispossessed of their land. Today, this view underlies arguments that we ought to make good or better use of the land, that we ought to build a road or ought to build a mine or ought to realise the use of the land that would otherwise be left idle, regardless of the cost to the land and what inhabits that land. This view has led and will lead to the extincting of species. First law, the traditional laws of the Aboriginal peoples of this state, takes a different view of the human relationship with land. And tonight I wish to draw our attention to how this notion of belonging, this notion of connection to the land, is articulated in the concept of sovereignty expressed in the Uluru Statement from the Heart. So the basic argument that I'd like to leave with tonight is that if we are to avert the sixth mass extinction, then parts of the first law of the state, the traditional laws and customs of the Aboriginal peoples of the state need to become entrenched, embedded somehow a part of the law that governs the use of land in this state, including land vested with the state and local governments. It would mean, in broad terms, an end to settler law as it has operated in this state since 1829, and which began on the furphy that the land of this state was both unoccupied and a wasteland, devoid of human value. And lastly, we seem sometimes to have lost the arts of reading and listening. And so, perhaps in the coming days, you might find a tree to sit under, to listen to the leaves, and to read and consider what is conveyed in the Uluru Statement from the Heart. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Hugh.
In a democracy, equality before the law is essential. Environmental campaigners do not easily have standing in court. The Stygo fauna of Yeliri do not have standing in court. The species threatened by climate change do not have standing in court, and when there is the chance to challenge a wrong decision, it needs cold, hard cash. And that's where you might come in. You may choose to donate to the campaign by going onto the Conservation Council website, because in our democracy now, corporations who want to mine have both standing to appeal and the money to hit the case hard with a row of barristers. In the Supreme Court case next week, it's not appealing against the mining companies, it's appealing against the state, specifically the State Minister for the Environment. A decision by a Liberal Environment Minister in the dying days of the Barnett government is being upheld by a Labor government, which could be in a position to review the basis for the decision. For now, it relies on the Supreme Court to come up with its own decision. Longer term, it falls on the environment movement to persuade any future state government to support an environment court, as is found in New South Wales. You've been with Understory and a bit of the presentations at UWA last week by lawyers connected with the Environmental Defenders Office, WA, Declan Doherty, Ruby Hamilton and Dr. Hugh Finn, as well as the Conservation Council of WA's Carmen Lawrence and Piers Verstegen, and Australian Conservation Foundation's Dave Sweeney.
I think it's also important to note that parallel to court, there's a court of public opinion. And last year, West Australians celebrated 10 years since Colin Barnett opened the door to uranium mining, making it one of his three priorities in government. 10 years where, because of community and First Nation resistance, there's no mines in this state. And justice, as we know, it should be on merit. It should not be on your financial capacity. Thanks for being here tonight.
This key issue may encourage a second listen and sharing with others even, in which case you can find this program online by Googling Understory blog. I'm Elizabeth Poe. Thanks so much to Adrian Glamorgan for technical assistance. And we'll be back same time, same planet next week, as there's always more, much more to explore with Understory.